Ladies and gentlemen, it's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation. And it's a great opportunity for me actually to reflect back on what has happened sort of in the last 10 years. And I have to confess, I am depressed. Yesterday, when I got here from the airport, I shared the elevator with four big garbage bins and the cleaning lady. And in one of those garbage bins, there was a whole stack of issues from the communications of the ACM from the last century. And what was on top of it? This one. March 1997, recommender systems, linking users by similar interests. So I decided I'll have a look what happened in the last 10 years. So all these papers were written more than a decade ago. And just to give us internet time here, they were written about 25% in World Wide Web time. Because it started like 93, 94, now it's 2006. So that was about a quarter of where we are right now. And as I said, I was depressed that all these promises there, well, I think most of it, I could just submit a paper right now and it would probably get accepted. And why have we not actually made the progress? Why can we still write the same papers? I mean, I just invite you here to flick through. Why can we still write the same papers? And why is it still sort of the level of people board X, also board Y, which is just making one big matrix, doing TF-IDF, and hoping for the best? So I think one of the answers here is that it is not just data analysis. It's not just statistics in the usual sense. But it is carrying out experiments where the difference lies. I've spent many evenings and over many bottles of wine in the stats department at the University of Washington. And we discussed, you know, what would we need to do in order to improve recommendation algorithms. And we always came to the same answer. Unless we can really not only get the files from eBay sent to us of what happened, but unless we can run experiments in real time, swapping different modules of algorithms in and out, I think progress will be just very, very hard. Okay, so what I want to do today is, however, I want to be forward-looking, and I want to talk about what we call Web 2.0, what we call Web 3.0, and then leave lots of space for you for discussions. I mean, 10 years ago, I was an associate professor at NYU Information Systems, and since then, I've done a number of things. I work with a number of companies in this Web 2.0, Web 3.0 areas, and I think probably you gain more from asking me questions and me trying to answer them than me just using a full hour and talking. So to set the stage, what is Web 2.0? Web 2.0 can best, in my perspective, be characterized by the reversal of a pyramid. This one is the old world. Professors pontificating, students listening. Or in France, the Académie Française deciding on how language is be used and the subjects using it. What we have been seeing in the last few years is that pyramid turning upside down. For me, that is a super exciting and empowering experience. It's no longer a few people who determine meaning, but it is Wittgensteinian, meaning equals use. Here are some implications of that. YouTube is a service out of the Bay Area where every day about 30 million downloads of videos happen. And every day about 35,000 new videos get uploaded. An example of that is two boys from Guangzhou called the Backdorm Boys, who are lip-syncing to the Backstreet Boys, had, I think, 14 million downloads within a short time, and now used by a major soft drink manufacturer in China as basically promoting that drink. So here is, just stepping back one step here, here is from Netflix, the on the x-axis the titles, on the y-axis logarithmic the number of turns they have per year. And what happens to be the case is that about half of the turns are not in physical stores. So by allowing discovery in the long tail through recommender systems a la 1996 in the CACM sitting there, they flatten this curve, and more stuff gets sent out which is in the tail of the distribution. So it's effect number one. Effect number two is that in the world of user-generated content, that tail here dramatically grows, like our Backdoor Boys from Guangzhou. And so those two effects don't cancel each other, but really push the head down, the head which, you know, sometimes is called the tyranny of the physical space, of stores where you actually have stuff sitting there and you have to worry about that you're selling it. So one, discovery mechanisms help us to get into the tail. Two, the creation of new items in the tail has changed probably by several orders of magnitude over the last couple of years. So that's one of the big differences between 10 years ago and now. That the barrier of creation, the barrier of entry, has basically gone down to zero. MySpace. Who of you has a MySpace account?
My daughter
does. Okay. There are two kinds of parents. There are those who know that their children have MySpace accounts. And those... Okay. 60 million people have MySpace accounts. And as you know, MySpace was sold last year for about 600 million. And that might seem like a large number, particularly if one of the founders. But if you think about it, it's $10 per person. That's not a huge user acquisition cost, $10 per person. By the way, MySpace made 79 cents per user last year. So not quite the earnings which are reflected in the price. In contrast to this, since we have a Korean here, if we take Cyworld there, Cyworld is mobile and internet. About more than 90% of people between, I think, 18 and 30 or something like this, actually are active Cyworld users. Cyworld. And there's a wonderful paper out of CMU actually on Cyworld addiction. So if you go to Google and enter Cyworld addiction, it's a great paper by a student, I think, graduate student at CMU. Now, Cyworld, however, makes about $10 a year off people. Why? Because they can create virtual items and they can trade those. And they expire after a certain time. So maybe you want to buy something for your friend, a blanket, because it's cold in Korea in the winter. And after 1 month, well, unless you renew the subscription for that blanket, your friend will be very cold. Your virtual friend will be virtually very cold. So they are very interesting things. But let's stay closer here to business. I wanted to make you one more remark here, that these recommendations from 10 years ago do work well. Here's the example which Neil Hunt, when he was teaching a class in my course at Stanford last year, used, that making the point that these simple recommendations, which are based on people explicitly saying how much they like a movie, are twice as big as whatever you can come up on the average. And interesting enough here that putting stuff on the homepage is only a quarter as good as doing these algorithmic recommendations. Small remark here, which brings me to the point I made last year when I was talking here, is there is this page Netflix includes. What this page about? It says, please be patient as we are analyzing your ratings and finding person recommendations. That gives a 2-digit lift of sales afterwards compared to not having that page. The page is not needed. But just giving the user the feeling that something is happening there, something good must be coming out. So that is what I want to call architecture experimentation. And the sad story for academics is that we don't have access to those experiments which the big companies all run. The secret behind Google, eBay, Amazon is that they just at any given point in time run hundreds of experiments. So this notion of this industrial economy notion that you ship a finished product, you know, who of you knows which version of Google you're using? Of course not. We all know that we are using XP or something like this, but that's a very different agile process of sometimes called, you know, constant beta, Flickr, the picture sharing service, which was bought by Yahoo a couple of years ago, said that they release new versions every half hour. So these are just very different ways of closing that feedback loop. And on internet time for me means to measure those things, basically small effects in real time. From there, I want to move to architectures of participation and show you some examples. That is what Web 2.0 is. And if you go, for instance, to Technorati or to Ice Rocket, they count 40 million blogs. 40 million blogs. So a word which I didn't hear in the last hour, which I would have expected to hear, is the word of RSS. Blogs are just, you know, one blip in the universe of, you know, people writing about what they had for breakfast in most cases. But RSS feeds are dramatically changing how communication is going to happen. For example, the fact that United sends out a newsletter in email is just, you know, so 90s in some way, because I want to read it when I want to read it, not when they feel like I should be reading it. And then what I read should be ranked from what my friends are reading. So the email behavior and the general staff behavior are totally different. And I think it's a question of a couple of years that email's behavior will change dramatically as a person-to-person communication. You know, by the way, I suppose, that the teenagers now think, and I last heard this, I think, a year ago at Stanford, when some person said, if you really want an email, I'll send you an email. But that's sort of for old people. And it really is a very different world of teenagers and undergraduates, at least, being totally immersed in IM, that in instant messaging, text messaging in China. I just talked to Danny Kahneman on Saturday, and we were thinking about whether the ways we have grown up in the last, you know, couple of 1,000 years, which of those ways still hold, given that our attention now is shared between dozens of friends who come in and go signing on. I can't do that. I'm too old for that. But, you know, you sit there and it says, oh, so-and-so just signed on. Oh, let me. No, you just ignore it. Well, why do you have it on then? So people sometimes, like the monkeys, you know, in the zoo, they have to be present to their fellow species there. And I don't know whether it's good or bad. I just don't know the application, the implications, but it is certainly a very different communication world we live in. So Web 2.0 is about architectures of participation, of producing stuff. It's about consumer-created content. 40 million blogs, little dots on the sky. Web 3.0 now is about connecting the dots. It's about architectures of interaction. Social networks and the difference between getting it right and getting it wrong is epsilon, which has a huge effect on the road. Social networks are examples of architectures of interaction. So I made this slide here for you, where I tried to think a little bit about where we were 20 years ago, that's when I was doing my PhD, 10 years ago, right after the Netscape IPO, and where we are right now. That's my view, and I just try to fit it on this one slide. So 10 years ago, we worried about stickiness. We worried about increasing the barrier of exit. Right? We made it hard for people to go from here to there. We made it hard for them to take out their data. Some companies like Google still try to do that. Google thinks they own my search data. What a pathetic view. I co-own my data, of course. Like if you go to A9, for instance, or to Amazon, you can simply take your purchase history out and say, how much would I have to pay for that at Barnes & Noble? So I think the question of ownership here was, you give us data and we own them and we are not letting you share them, to the much more syndication view, which we have 10 years later, where it's about lowering the barrier of entry. Different philosophy. This one, somewhat limited. That one is, I think, what's much more exciting. So people are now producers. People are co-creators. There's a network of people commenting on each other. And sometimes it's called the read-write web. Let me show you as an example here. My HTML 1.0 page. And when I click, for example, here on tags, this now goes to Delicious, and that page now surfaces all the people who add little tags to my homepage. So now this suddenly is a very different geography on top of the web. The old web was about control. I am putting in the links to where I want to put the links in. It got somewhat softened by Google finding things which might have a similar content. But now this is Web 2.0. There are people, I don't know any of these people here, who write in different languages. In this case, I was in German last week, so it's German, and there's some Spanish there. And Lu Fan sounds, Chinese. Shanghai. So these are people who find it worth putting sort of little tags onto my page. Why do they do this? Well, I think primarily for themselves. So why do people do stuff? Well, I think selfishness is a good initial idea. Why do they put it up on the server? Because they might have several computers, or the Chinese people might just share some computer and some lab. So let's just put them up somewhere. The power now comes from those being public. And I've worked with Joshua Schachter, Delicious, and we had lots of debates of whether should allow people to have private tags or whether should make it public. And Joshua was a very, very strong fan of saying, let's make it only public tags, which excludes, of course, some people who want to have sort of their IP in what they have discovered there. Because if you discovered one tag and you click on the tag, then you actually see everything else they discovered in the world. So this is one example here of Web 2.0, where people with an absolute minimum barrier of entry can tag websites. And the power is not that it's just done for them, but the selfishness becomes selflessness, if you will, by them sharing it with the rest of the world. So you can then, of course, here explore in saying, what might be interesting here, e-commerce, and now you dive in and discover here for this person, Rai, what other stuff has he looked at in e-commerce, or you can discover who else has looked at a certain page. For example, here's a page, personalization, customization, there is another person. So you see how the discovery here works in a very different way. It's not statistical discovery. It's not us coming up with better recommender systems, but it is much more people-based. It's not taking average of a population, but it is following an individual. So that is quite different from what we had 10 years ago. Sometimes, tongue-in-cheek, we say that there used to be the notion of creating a controlled taxonomy. That really didn't work. It's just not the way the world works. Items are part of many groups. Let's simply call it, as I said, tongue-in-cheek, a taxonomy. And that's what I just showed you. Next dimension is the web 10 years ago had this spatial metaphor. And it was a static web. Even my old web page here doesn't have a temporal dimension to it. In contrast, the web now has a very strong temporal dimension to it. The order parameter really has become time. So for that also, a little demo. If, for example, I say, so who actually is talking about me right now, and do that on Technorati? This is here, whatever was 12 hours ago, this was 1 day ago. Somebody seems to have some things on graduate school here. OMI News is another thing which came out of Korea, where it's a citizen newspaper. There are, I don't know the number, maybe 10,000 citizens who write a newspaper. And do you happen to know the numbers? No. Yeah. I just recommend you actually get a feeling of how big of a movement that is. I looked at it like 1-2 years ago, and I actually forgot the numbers right now. But so here's somebody, and that apparently already runs in Germany, this OMI News things. This is really this reversal of the pyramid, which I showed you before. That's putting things upside down. And the interesting thing is that nowadays you can actually access those little traces people leave primarily for themselves. Okay, next one. How does discovery work? That, I think, is for me at the heart. How do we discover stuff? Well, 20 years ago, it was that people send us email. Remember sitting in Germany 20 years ago, somebody sending me an email from America. Wow, what an experience. 10 years ago, it was discovery based on hyperlinks, and then soon thereafter, based on search. And as I said, hyperlinks are controlled by the authors, so they have you discover only what they want to discover. Usually they won't, authors won't necessarily have links to papers which tell that they're idiots. Companies won't really have links to competing products. To some degree, search, which we sometimes call Web 1.5, which had the problem of initially finding stuff, quickly changed to the problem of showing the most relevant stuff on top, was the way of discovery in Web 1.0, Web 1.5. Now, discovery is happening in very different ways. And the two ways I want to highlight is one, based on social data, and two, based on metadata. Let's start with metadata. In 1999, we started a company called MoodLogic, and MoodLogic had as its purpose to find, to collect metadata about music on the song level, in order to help people discover songs they didn't know about. So I devised a survey of 35 questions and ran it, you know, as a few subjects at school first, but then we rolled it out on the web. We never paid people. After a couple of years, we had 1 billion explicit clicks where people told us about songs. We could have never paid people for that. Even if people pay them a cent per click, that would have been $10 million. So people actually, this is sort of what I learned very early on in the center here. People are willing to do stuff, as we saw with the tagging, if it's of interest to them, and if they don't have the feeling that you try to control them. Many companies are not understanding that yet. I've talked to a large German publisher, large magazine publisher in Russia also and in Italy, and he wanted to have blogs, but please, only blogs that have the same political conviction as he does. It's just not happening that way. That is the story about the metadata. For the social relations, there is an interesting company in Germany called OpenBC, standing for Open Business Club. It is similar to LinkedIn in the United States. And what OpenBC does in a very smart way, it allows people to rate how much they trust the other person. Then it also looks at asymmetries. If I say, I totally trust Mark, but Mark says, Andreas, no way I would trust the guy with even a penny to bring me some coffee. But we, of course, don't surface those data because that might sort of cause a slight, you know, problem between the two of us. But we use it in computing things about the different people. And then also we allow people to tag, what do I trust them in? So when it comes to marketing, absolutely. When it comes to finding good food, absolutely. When it comes to making travel reservations, I have no clue whether you would be able to help me find a cheap flight from here to Germany. So that way we collect about people stuff, but we collect it in a way that is useful for the person who sorts the colleagues or the acquaintances he has in OpenBC, because if he wants to find somebody who knows about marketing, there's a tag about him. So exploiting these asymmetries is interesting. Then another way there is, who are the people you think are the cool people who show you new stuff first? And that helps us finding innovators by getting to the people. So the difference is that at Amazon.com, where I worked with Jimmy Pang, for instance, on finding early adopters and finding the people who have a good feeling of what will be cool, we only looked at the data. Not as strong as providing people with an architecture of participation where they can do something which is useful for them, and then we have much more fun in looking at those implicit data in addition to the explicit data they give us. What's important is to just set it up so we can get as much as possible out of it. At its heart is that we moved from clicks to search terms which already have more information in them, because you can only click on something which is on the page. But when you search for something, you express your intention. And every day there are, you know, about maybe 1,000 intention exchanges which you have, or intention expressions. Where's the bathroom? An example of you have an intention. But more powerful than the intention and more specific is actually to express attention. Attention on the web is really well done by labeling stuff. Now think about it. You found something which you're looking for, and you're now adding a tag to it. So you think, as you're fully focused on this, how should I call that thing so I will be able to retrieve it later. And as soon as you give that tag as an example of giving attention to something, as soon as you give that tag, you will see how other people use that tag. So that's how this taxonomy actually evolves. In giving people working hard and being concentrated on doing something, as opposed to paying some monkeys to, let's say, organize songs according to how they feel right now, and they might just feel, I want to go home. Sometimes in the business school, people talk about managerial issues. From a managerial perspective, there really are three issues. The technological issue, or technical issue. The societal issue, and, or let's say, the risk of PR. And the third one is the incentives. How do I set it up so people actually do things? For example, Amazon.com uses wikis now since like 2 or 3 weeks ago. So people can, similar to Wikipedia, who of you has a Wikipedia entry? Okay, just like 3-4 people. And so you all know what a wiki is. I assume we collaboratively focus on TextRate. So product descriptions are very hard. So the idea of letting the customers actually write their own product descriptions, as opposed to this sort of reviews, which are not that coherent often as you look through them. Besides reviews, like some books have thousands of reviews, which all say, yeah, it's a good book and stuff like this. So it's really not that useful. So why don't we give wikis to people? And on the wiki side here, the question is, how much of it do we need to do such that people participate? That is the hardest question, setting incentives. You saw in the case of Delicious that the top entry was the guy who first tagged my page. So what do you need to give to people such that they participate? These are the deep questions. Technology questions have become simple. So that actually is a big difference to the CACM issue there, that nowadays integration of a recommender system such as Bruce D'Ambrosio's CleverSet, for instance, is, you know, less than 24 hours because Ajax and other things, the computation now actually happens on the web as opposed to you try to go into the company and get it done there. And the PR issue, the risks people have, companies overestimate this and they don't underestimate that without taking the risk, nobody will come play. Let me see what I have. Another couple of examples of these participation things, and then I'll just turn it over for you. Here's an example of a little box which we came up with at Amazon.com, where we said every day we have millions of people looking at our site. How can we capture their attention? And not capture their attention to push some stupid stuff down their throats, but how can we capture their attention when they see little bugs in our site? And the idea was just to have this box, and you can write whatever you want at the bottom of the box. And there are about 500 to 1,000 such forms which come back in a given day. So all you need to know to do is pay one person, and they don't need to be particularly qualified, to manually sort them, to send them to the right departments. And you constantly learn new stuff about where your site is wrong. Then this happened about 2 years ago, that Amazon said the local market for shops is about $70 billion, $90 billion, the local yellow pages. That's a big market. That's multiple of Amazon's market capitalization. How can we tap into the local market? And then there were a couple of trucks which just drove through the cities, in this case San Francisco, close to where I live, and they took all these pictures. Similar idea to Mood Logic in 99. We can't pay people to do this for us, to fix those pictures. But we have to just tap into those people who actually care. And in this case, for example, if I own a shop, I would care that the picture is the right picture. So now with a simple interface, you have the choice of maybe clicking this button, or maybe it's that. You decide on which is the right picture, and then you just submit it, and this way, this for the Costco in San Francisco is actually a good picture. I want to close in talking a little bit more about this button up here and how I personally see the next monetization of stuff to happen. So this is new. I haven't talked about that. And I want to see what you guys think. So in this case, it was a button which is basically taking the cost per click that you pay for a click as a you pay for a call model. And when I teach, I demo it. Last time I was teaching in Singapore, I clicked the button and I had a very confused person at Costco when I explained I'm in Singapore right now and just demoing it to class. So the phone actually rings at the Costco and somebody picks up the phone and they pay whatever it is, 10 cents to Amazon. And presumably they'll get many calls from Singapore from a business call where people say, oh, just demoing cost, clicking here. Because the phone, they don't know that the call comes in a different way than if I actually dialed the number manually. So where do I think things are going here in this Web 2.0, Web 3.0 dimension? We saw that the social aspect and the what I call architecture of interaction is, I think, an important element. There we have two poles at the end. One is maintenance, that I want to maintain my friends. If somebody changed their mobile phone number, I want to still be able to call them. The first degree relationships as we have them in Cyworld. And on the other end, we have discovery. The world is a big place. Lots of people want to talk to lots of people. The problem is that we don't have ways of prioritizing this. If you think about your mobile phone is so smart. It knows who your friends are, presumably the people who have phone numbers in. It knows your schedule, so it knows where you are right now. It, in my case, also knows my email, and that knows who I respond to right away and who I just don't get to responding to. And it knows my to-do list. Yet it is so dumb. It either rings or it doesn't ring, namely when I turn it off. How pathetic can that be? So right now, when I give a talk, of course, I don't want my phone to ring. You know, if you're listening to the talk here, maybe you don't mind if your phone rings. Maybe it's more interesting than listening to Andreas. But those things, we have a completely untapped market. So I think we have, as I said before, maybe 100 times more attention exchanges than we have monetary exchanges. So I want to create a market for attention. So with VOIP, voice over IP, the virtual phone numbers are virtually free to create, so to speak. I would like to have good till cancel numbers. One for you, one for you, one for you. So for each of these numbers, I'm willing to charge a price, or I'm willing to pay you. So if Mark calls me, hey, I'm happy to pay you if you call, because I know it will be super. If somebody else calls me, well, maybe I charge something. And if somebody calls me who I haven't talked to, then maybe I charge more. So, for example, I would like to have, let's say, at a dating site, maybe this behavior, that I charge, whatever, $10 for the first 3 minutes. And if we are still talking then, hey, I'm happy to pay for it. I got paid for my last consulting gig last week via PayPal and mobile phone. Somebody just entered send amount to 650-906-5906. So I would expect that there's a similar number. I say, now I'm available for, you know, $1 a minute, waiting for the plane Chicago yesterday, where I got the very intelligent answer from the United agents, who said, I said, so when are we actually going to board? After the plane is here, young man. That was certainly a true answer, but didn't help me much. In this case, I would have said, hey, you know, I'm willing to talk to anybody for free right now. So think about that. You know, you are very smart people who think about models, who know about economics, about fixed points and stuff like that. From the technology we are here, the technological elements are in place. The payment is here. The notification system, at least in Asia, is very omnipresent. Here we are getting there. That short messages typically don't take more than a couple of hours to arrive. And now it's time to just do that, and then we can actually study. Will people become more aware of how much their time is worth? You know all these books on how to lose weight? They're basically simple. They're like, I think, 800 books at Amazon on how to lose weight, and they say, eat less, exercise more. So the secret there is that people want to understand, or people need to understand, what it really means that they're doing. For people who use a Mac, this is a wonderful application here. It's one guy who was a grad student at MIT and now works for France Telecom, Edison Thomas, who just wrote a little app which allows you to see how you spend your time. And there's another company in New York called Root Markets, root.net, which allows you to download a Firefox plugin, which then starts recording every single click you do, and you can find out how much time you spend on Google and how much time you spend on other things. So understanding about yourself, and then learning to monetize your time. Well, monetizing doesn't mean that everyone should make money here. It could be happily, as I said, that I tell, hey, if Mark calls, I'm more than happy to actually pay him, if you will. And he might also be happy to pay me. So how would the company work? Great. He pays the company, I pay the company. We never know that we're paying each other. So that, I think, in terms of architecture of interaction, is for me the way I see things going. To summarize, I reflected in this 30 minutes or so on how discovery has changed over the last 10, 15 years. Discovery used to be by people, then by hyperlinks pages put in, then by search. Recommender systems haven't changed in the last decade. And I invite you to flip through the issues in front of you here. However, what has changed is that people are willing to do much more explicit work than we ever expect them to do. Millions of blogs getting created every month. People tagging millions of websites. In moments when they really actually have their attention focused on the task at hand. Those data are much more valuable for discovery than just the implicit data which we collected before. From the architecture of participation, which I've talked about right now, we are moving towards architecture of interaction. That means we should collect data about the interaction between people, using the tagging paradigm, the flat namespace paradigm, which has worked very well in the architecture of participation. And my personal belief is, for it to really take off, we need to add the dimension of having some payment system, which might be real money or might be funny money. I don't know that yet. And that's what I sort of wanted to present here.